And coming up next on Bathrop Spears Broadsides on 101.1 FM, it's Me and You, perhaps, and special guest Jim Gottstein. It could be Jim Gottstein. It probably is. He'll be calling in from Alaska to talk about psychiatric abuses. That's at 6:15, so stay with us.
There's an alien life form been creeping round my job site. Oh, they look almost human, but something about them ain't right. They just cross right over a picket line. Pay no attention to a picket sign. They're called scabs. Scabs. The lowest life form spawned in nature's lab. They got no brain. They got no heart. Scabs are tearing our communities apart. They might be reptilian. The blood flows like ice in their veins. Or extraterrestrial recyclers that use shit for brain. Now what does it mean to have the right to strike when companies do anything they like using scabs? The lowest form of life found in nature's lab. They got no brain, they got no heart. Scabs are tearing our communities apart. Now before we had our union, let me tell you, conditions were bad. Understaffed, overworked, underpaid, till we finally got mad. But then when we walked out to protect our rights, they just gave away our jobs to those parasites, to those scabs. Scabs. The lowest form of life found in nature's lab. They got no brain. They got no heart. Scabs are tearing our communities apart. I could puke watching co-workers turned into weasels and traitors. Pod people hatched by those corporate raiders and insider traders. You know our labor laws are crazy. They're so damn two-faced. They say I haven't been fired, just permanently replaced by scabs. Scabs. The lowest form of life found in nature's lab. They got no brain. They got no heart. Scabs are tearing our communities apart. Oh, listen to your mama. This isn't idle gab. You're pretty damn low on the food chain when you think you gotta grab your striking neighbor's job. I guess you gotta be a scab.
And that was Ann Feeney. From Look to the Left and Scabs. That was the name of the song. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norris, and this, as you may have gathered, if you're a regular listener or if you just tuned in, is Bathrop Spears Broadsides, which is a twice-weekly show concerned with local issues, civil rights for the poor. It's call-in, and got some cranky music, too, every now and then. Today, as I mentioned, we have an interview with Jim Gottstein, who is going to be calling in shortly. He's an Alaska psychiatrist who's also had a number of, at least one serious run-in with the psychiatric institutional system, and he's been fighting for a significant period of time to guarantee or to encourage people to guarantee basic rights and significant change in the current institutional psychiatry system, which we are living under. A lot of folks sort of don't pay much attention to it because it doesn't touch their lives directly. But once it touches your life directly, it's a very serious matter. You can be forcibly held, forcibly medicated. You can be conserved. You suddenly find your rights, or even the right to a court appearance, is a major struggle. And we've talked about on the air the dangerous effects of psychiatric drugs. We may talk about that again today with Jim when we get him on at 6:15. But one of the problems even before that is, what do you do when you're picked up and forced into a choice? Either we get to shoot you up with this, or, you know, either you take this medication voluntarily or we'll shoot you up with it. And indeed, there has been a movement in California for involuntary outpatient commitment, what I call needles on wheels. It's been passed by the California legislature, but it hasn't quite reached the funding stage, although Proposition, was it 63 last November, is being touted by some psychiatric professionals as a way to fund it, and there's still a debate going on with that. I'm not quite sure what the outcome is. I read an article in the current Street Spirit, the homeless newspaper, which you can pick up by giving a call to Becky Johnson, who is a Street Spirit vendor. She's in the phone book under Johnson. She's the only Becky Johnson if you're a telephone user. You can also find it at the Homeless Service Center. Anyway, there's a interesting article in the current issue of Street Spirit on Berkeley activist Michael Diehl's struggle to make sure that psychiatric treatments are actually voluntary and serve the interests of those who supposedly they're intended for, particularly around poor people and people who are living outside, so that they are simply not treated as a social disease and, eradicated or swept out of sight, who got God knows where. So, while you're pondering these matters, and while you're waiting, perhaps, I'm waiting, perhaps you're waiting with me for a call-in from Alaska, I'm going to whip out a few interviews, or actually, they've already been done. You can see what you think. If you want to call in, you're going to be able to call into the show either now or even while our guest is on the air, because we have two lines in, 427-3772. Or if you're out of the area, 831-427-3772 is the phone number to call. And you'll catch me here in the studio. Pages in Color does not seem to be working. That's our chat room. It says cannot join channel, so it looks like I can't get on, but maybe you can. I'll keep an eye on that, see if anybody jumps on. Has something to say. That's at pagesincolor.com. I can't guarantee you can get in there. Sounds like a caller is calling in even as I speak. Let's see what's cooking with that. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hey, Chris Brazda, candidate, U.S. House of Representatives.
Hey, Chris.
I just got out of jail. Officer Briley came up to me.
Hang on, Chris. You got to hold for a second. We have a second call. Can you hold for a second?
All right.
Hang on just a moment. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, this is Jim Godstein.
Hey, Jim. You're about 3 or 4 minutes early. I'm glad you called in. We have another caller on the line who's actually you want to listen in while we listen to him and then go to you.
Yeah, I just thought I'd call in early.
Sure, stay tuned. Hey, Chris, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, Chris. So give us the scoop. What's happening?
Okay, Tuesday I announced on my webpage I would go out in front of Pete's and do some pamphlet hearing. Hand out some cards for my campaign and do a set of yoga. And at 10:30, Officer Briley came up to me and observed my activity, which amounted to handing people cards saying, "I'm Chris Brazda, I'm running for the Congress, and this is my website." And that's it, and that's what I did.
This was downtown on Pacific Avenue?
Right.
And this is in front of the Pacific Trading Company?
In front of the Pete's Coffee House.
Pete's Coffee House, okay. And what happened?
He said, "You're too close to me, back up, or I'm going to drop you on the ground." So I backed up, and I told him my platform, you know, build fusion reactors, get a direct democracy, get out of Iraq and peace to president, Truth and Reconciliation Committee for the Commission for the Cold War, give those killers immunity, but we have to uncover them so they don't drive the war on terror, take the profit out of the war industries by nationalizing the defense industries. Apparently, he wasn't happy with my program. He did arrest me.
What for?
Disturbing the peace.
And what did he say that you were doing that constituted disturbing the peace?
He didn't tell me anything. I haven't seen a police report. I just got out of jail at 3.
How long have you been in jail?
2 days. And I was forced to take 120 milligrams of Geodon. I'm on 40. Dr. Mula forced 120 on me, forced a shot first of 40. I resisted that. They dropped me on the floor from standing to my stomach. They did that twice. They had me in overtight handcuffs. They kept me for 6 hours. They kept me incommunicado 1 day. They wouldn't allow me any pens and pencils for 2 days until I just got out, actually.
Huh. This is in the Dominican psych ward?
No, this was in the O ward at Santa Cruz Jail.
I see. So they were medicating you in the jail?
Yes, they were.
Or I should say forcibly sticking you with needles. Actually, on the line with us, we also have somebody who's been actually doing some research and has probably handled some cases in that area. You want to sign in, caller?
Yeah, Jim Gottstein.
And Jim, you're an attorney up in Alaska, and you're also a man who's had some experience with the psychiatric system yourself.
Yes.
What do you think of Chris's account? Do you have any reactions to it?
Well, I wish I could say I was surprised, but I'm not. I think it's very common. And my big problem is that it's basically illegal what people do. I mean, what the correction systems do. It's against people's rights, but there really aren't any lawyers to speak of that are trying to protect people's rights.
And Chris, have you ever tried to get an attorney and been
asked Jim to take the case, but he says since he won't do it since he's running a nonprofit organization.
Who did you ask to take the case?
Jim Gottstein.
Oh, you asked me. Jim's in Alaska, though. I don't think.
Yeah, I'm not licensed in California, so I can't do it. But I've got the IRS. Told us basically that damage cases, so that where you're trying to get money, is not a charitable activity, and therefore, the Law Project for Psychiatric Rights or Psych Rights, who I'm working with, can't do it. That would destroy its nonprofit status.
Yeah,
and they said if I took it,
attorney.
And then they said if I took it as a private lawyer, that they would consider I was misusing the nonprofit to direct.
So you've arranged it so you can't take a case for a client then.
Well, it's damage types cases where you're trying to sue to get money. Trying to sue to prevent forced drugging in jail is something that I have done. In fact, I caught the Alaska Department of Corrections red-handed with violating people's constitutional rights.
But the most effective method is to force them is to sue them for money, for damages.
What do you think about that, Jim? Is that true in your view?
I think that would be a very good thing to do, yes.
Chris, I guess the question I had for you, though, was have you ever approached a local attorney and tried to get some kind of redress? Because this has happened to you before, right?
Right. They produced a major depression in 2002 with Depakote. Actually, the same doctor did it. Mula.
But I'm talking about that's actually the second part of this, and that's probably the part we're going to be talking about, the psychiatric mistreatment. But you were also arrested by the Santa Cruz Police Department, right?
Right. I was arrested for photographing Supervisors Butte and Wormhout, and I did 180 days in confinement.
And this time, however, apparently you're down to 2. What, do they think you're less of a menace this time? Or?
Well, I got out, and I saw my psychiatrist, Dr. Natu, a Hindu psychiatrist, and I told her what happened, and she's not recommending any more than 50 Geodon. So I asked her to call Dr. Mula and talk to him, and I called Norm Wyman, who's the director of mental health, and I told him what happened. I had a promise from Dr. Lowe, the director of psychiatry, to come in, but Mula, if I was arrested or subject to forced treatment, but he didn't do it because Dr. Mula wouldn't call him. You know, I'm talking to these people. They have very little time to talk. Public psychiatry is malpractice by virtue of time constraints.
Chris, do you have a court date, or are you just are they charging you with anything?
Yes, they're charging me with disturbing the peace.
And when is your court date?
I'm not sure. I'd have to look around for
a paper. Listen, why don't you let us know? I'm going to clear the line so other callers can get in so I can get Jim to introduce himself more fully.
All right.
And if you want, you can call back at some point.
All right.
All right. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So we're on the line then with Jim Gottstein. Hey, Jim. Thank you very much for calling in.
You bet.
And paying for the call, I might add. Let's begin with your background. Have you always been interested in you work on a website, you work for a nonprofit up in, is it Anchorage?
Yes. But we've really got kind of a national focus.
Uh-huh. So it's appropriate that you're talking about California issues and the way people here are treated as well.
What we're trying to do is organize a legal effort against forced drugging and electroshock around the country I would like to analogize it to what the NAACP and Thurgood Marshall did in the 40s and 50s against segregation.
Which, you know, actually seemed to go nowhere until suddenly the dam broke and it went somewhere.
Well, I think what it does is demonstrate the way that legal cases can really change things, and I think it also demonstrated people power, which is it was... You know, the demonstrations and the marches and those kind of things in combination with the legal cases.
You're talking about the ending of at least de jure segregation, although de facto segregation is a fact of life these days a lot. Can you hold? Actually, we have a caller calling in briefly. Do you mind? Let's take this caller and see what he says.
You bet.
Hi, you're on Free Radio with Jim and Robert.
Yes, hi. I was wondering if I could hear the program and. Because I'm trying to get it on my computer and I can't, and I was just wondering if I could ask a question as well as Jim
sure.
Gottstein
mm-hmm.
when he's on.
Go ahead. He's on right now.
Oh, he is. Okay,
actually,
I'm
say
sorry.
Hello, Jim.
I can't get the. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
I'm calling. I don't know exactly what you're discussing other than the psychiatric abuses at this moment, but I was just wondering with all of the psychiatric abuses in our prison system. How we can alleviate some of these, and especially with not being able to have family members have contact with their loved ones.
Well, I think that challenges to the drugging in the prisons should be canon should be made, and I'm talking about legal challenges. There are some constitutional rules that. I think are regularly violated, and it'd be good to be able to challenge that. In terms of family contact, are you saying where people are not allowed to contact family members?
Right. Well, in particular, I, his mother, am not allowed to see my son.
Yeah.
In California, and he's in a hospital.
What county is that?
That's in, I believe it's San Luis Obispo.
Uh-huh. And what happens when you try to go see him?
I was refused.
And does he want to see you? Does he try to reach you?
Oh, he did. He wanted to come down the first time. I mean, he's always, it's just, there are times when he doesn't want to see us, and that's fine, but there are times when he does, and it's very difficult anyway because he's like a six-hour car drive away.
Mm-hmm.
That was because the prison and the hospital have a contract. So that's why he was sent there.
He's in prison and he's been transferred to a hospital? Or?
Right. He's doing his parole in a hospital.
You know, I've been reading a lot recently about the kind of execrable treatment people get in prisons generally medically, and I guess, is this... What do you find happens up in Alaska around this situation? You can talk nationwide about it too, Jim.
Well, I'm not as familiar with what's going on in the prisons, although I'm trying to think, there was recently a report about it in California, wasn't there, about how terrible it is and how people are actually dying, and it's not uncommon for... Go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's... I read probably the similar news accounts of the same report, that there's a significant number of deaths, and
right.
That does actually talk about some kind of federal receivership.
Right.
How old is your son?
He's 29.
What's he being held for?
Well, it was withdrawal from psychiatric drugs. He was on 3,500 milligrams of psych drugs a night, plus more, plus PRNs, plus, you know, a shot of Haldol every 2 weeks. it was like a, you know, a drug problem. They created more of a drug problem to counteract a drug problem.
And he was, what was he convicted of? What was he?
Well, it was with me, and there was no charges. There were no charges against him placed by me, but a witness basically. What happened is I tripped over his foot, and he fell on top of me. He was not very coherent when the whole incident occurred. But it's not as though I've pressed charges in any way. It's
but
just we have this. I'm not antagonistic, but I don't agree with the system and I don't agree with the drugging.
What county are you in?
I'm in San Diego.
And were you? Did he get a jury trial?
No, it was a judge.
He pled.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, he wasn't. He really wasn't. Too. He was a bit non-compos mentis, as I guess the term.
Huh.
So
he was in withdrawal, and it has done some damage. Drugs have definitely done their dastardly deed, both psychiatric and, you know, the street drugs were not as big a problem, though, for him as the psychiatric drugs proved to be.
You know, I was going to ask Jim about, you know, alternatives to psychiatric drugging, given the kind of incredible, you know, both physical addiction and the kind of withdrawal symptoms you face with these psychiatric drugs.
Right, and we were in a Harvard study actually, which was working, and they will have no word of it. They do not want to have any kind of information given to them. They don't want to listen to it. They don't want to be told about it.
Wait a minute.
Like,
so your son was a part of a Harvard study,
mm-hmm.
but once. What was the nature of the study?
It's actually for nutrients, and it was working. It was a nutrient protocol, which was minerals and
nutrients rather than psychiatric medication.
Yep, and it was working very well.
Did you withdraw him immediately, or just part? Did he withdraw immediately, or just
unfortunately,
partially?
He was throwing up, so he withdrew himself immediately. That was the problem.
Huh.
And so once you go into spontaneous withdrawal. Every time he got his medications, this was up in Washington, and it was court-ordered. He was court-ordered to take these medications, and we told him he's throwing them up, and the judge said, no matter. And then the mental health people said, sorry, we can't do anything. He's in the court system.
Down in San Diego, are there any alternative groups? I know Scientologists have this, separate group. What is it? The civil rights group. What's the name of that, Jim? Do you know?
The Commission on Human Rights.
Right,
yes,
and there's some
very, very helpful. I've worked with them for a long time. But
yeah,
they can't come in and help you with your kid when you're having a difficult time in your home, which does sometimes happen. Because even still with these drugs still in his system, even when he's getting better, he has moments that are not very good. And I think that's what they're all afraid of. We can handle them, but, it's like it's a long time to get somebody back on their feet.
Well, this leads me to two questions. Actually, I got three. One is, of course, it's the people, even outside of prisons face all kinds of, hurdles trying to use alternate therapies.
Right.
But in prisons, I don't know, it sounds like it's, almost impossible. Is there...
You're right.
I mean, maybe there's a religious avenue because there recently was, federal legislation, what was it, a decade ago that extended religious rights. And, we have a fundamentalist president and that sort of thing. So, So possibly that's an avenue. Any thoughts on that, Jim?
Well, I think, the fundamentalist president, as long as, you're Christian. But I think if you're a Christian Scientist, you'd have a pretty good argument. I think it would be very hard if it wasn't some kind of mainstream, a pretty well recognized religion. And then basically when you're in prison, they essentially own you and they do all kinds of things, and
right.
And the courts have traditionally had a pretty hands-off attitude. Sometimes they'll get involved, but they tend not to. I will say, I think there's a the Ann Sippy Clinic is in San Diego, and I think it offers non-drug alternatives.
What is the name?
Ann Sippy.
Ann Sippy.
S-I-P-P-I. I don't know that it, can help your son at this point because
okay.
of where he's at. And it's kind of confusing to me about what his legal status is. If he's
I'm sorry, what's his legal status?
Yeah, I
mean,
you're
legally
saying he wasn't
he'll be
convicted of anything,
supposedly going to CONREP, but that's only if he can be, you know, right now he's in his own world.
What's CONREPs?
CONREP is where they send you after you have done your time. You so, never are free. You're so, never free.
What, wait a minute,
so is he being, you talked about him being, was he,
was convicted of something.
To stand trial?
Pardon me?
It sounded like you said he wasn't convicted.
Well, he was.
What was he convicted of and what was he sentenced to?
Assault on me, even though I didn't testify.
And what was the sentence?
And the sentence was 3 years. And he did that, and then he's now going to, will have spent another 3 years at Atascadero State Hospital. And then he's going to be maybe released. You know, if we fight it, and we did fight it, and they, it's interesting because when we got a lawyer and we did, they didn't exactly know how to do it. It was a friend who was helping me, and she wrote a habeas corpus, and they let him go. They had certified him last year, and then in a month they decertified him and let him come home, but they had this no contact, and it was with, you know, against me, and I didn't. I told them, you can't let my kid go out and in with, you know, he'll start withdrawing again because the doctor again.
But let me understand this. No contact was a provision. You couldn't talk to him or he couldn't talk to other people or what was
no,
that?
No contact with me.
Why did they say no contact with you? Oh,
because I was the person who was who fell on the floor and became unconscious when I tripped over his foot.
Wow.
But they looked at it as he had, you know, thrown me to the floor.
Who persuaded him to plead guilty to this?
I'm sure it was his...
public defender.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Wow. You know, what's your first name?
My name's Marilyn.
Hey, Marilyn. I appreciate your calling in. And are you getting any help at all from this? Any information that's helpful for you?
Well, you know, I can't get to, and I was hoping that I could be sort of hooked in on the radio, but because I can't get to it here in San Diego, and my computer won't pull you up. So
you can't get the radio is it's not really possible. It's through it's www.freakradio.org. If you
and I tried, and my computer won't pull you in.
We may be able. The show may be archived. Right now, it's not, but hopefully within a week or two, we're going to archive it on the website Huff Santa Cruz HUFF Santa Cruz, all one word, all small letters.
Okay.
HuffSantaCruz.org. So
okay.
You can try to find it there. I appreciate your calling in, but I'm going to clear the line so other people can
understand.
Yeah, and it's not just well, the real life situation you're giving us is as important as any theoretical discussions we could have, and probably more important, and also provides an occasion for us to talk about any other thoughts for Marilyn or on this case before we go, Jim.
Well, I think the main message I would have is that Marilyn's story is not unusual. It happens every day of the week all around the country.
True.
And people think that we have a country that's built on laws and following laws and have this justice. But when people get caught up in, I don't even call it the mental health system, the mental illness system, and then especially if they get what I call a reputation, God help them.
Yep.
And they really have no rights, and they're these pretend legal proceedings with the shams really, kangaroo courts, with in large part the public defenders really being a sham. They're not even really representing.
And right now, your son is out of jail, but he's being held in some sort of hospital situation?
In a hospital. And it's
Atascadero.
It's being investigated by the DOJ, the Department of Justice.
On what grounds?
Oh, abuse, over-drugging, you name it, patients dying.
Wow.
They're shredding all their papers right now.
You know, if you'd like to call back, I do a show Sunday from 9:30 to 1, if you want to give us an update
on what's happening, feel free to do it. I mean, this show is mostly concerned with local Santa Cruz city and county homeless issues, but But I'm also concerned with psychiatric abuse, because just as Jim is working in Alaska and his work has national importance, similarly, I think that this is an issue that's not limited any one locality. So call back on Sunday between 9:30 and 1. We'll talk more. You won't be able to talk to Jim. You'll be able to talk to us, and you'll be able to talk about what's been happening.
I will then. Thank you so much, Robert, and thank you, Jim.
Hey.
You
all right.
Thanks, Marilyn. Bye-bye. And you can call in. We're talking with Jim Gottstein and you here on Free Radio, 101.1 FM at www.freakradio.org. Call-in number is 427-3772, 831-427-3772. So, Jim, you have a website, psychrights.org?
Yes.
And that's a good place to find a lot of legal background to the struggle against psychiatric oppression, right?
I think it's fair to say it's very deep in information. We have a lot of the scientific information that debunks the basically fraudulent story that's being told about these drugs. It's a section called scientific research by topic, where people can actually download the full studies and articles, which we, being from, you know, pirate station or whatever you call it, might appreciate this. We shamelessly kind of copy and post these articles because we think it's important.
You are copyright violators.
It's fair use, Robert.
Oh, well, sure. That's what they all say.
So, no, I think that it is.
I notice you have Grace Jackson's book here. I don't think she's going to object. We had her on the air a couple weeks ago. In fact, I think she's the one, or either she or Robert Whitaker, sent me in your direction. Both of them, of course, have written books about how psychiatric medications are primarily pretty much fraudulent. Isn't that pretty much the bottom line for at least? I mean, I suppose in some cases some people may find it beneficial, but there's becoming increasing evidence that they, both the old line ones and the newer ones, are long term much worse than, or significantly worse than not taking any at all. Right?
Well, Bob Whitaker recently wrote an article that appears in Ethical Human Psychology and Psychiatry called "Anatomy of an Epidemic: Psychiatric Drugs and the Astonishing Rise of Mental Illness in America," which we have posted on our website, but that's actually with Bob's permission. And he shows that just by going through basic demographic research, that there's been a fourfold increase in serious psychiatric patient episodes since 1955, when Thorazine was introduced, and that the disability rate has increased almost six times in that same period of time. Then these are psychiatric disabilities, people that are disabled by they're disabled by psychiatry. And what's happened is that we're creating this whole class of people. We're making them permanently mentally ill by these medications. And now I won't say that some people aren't helped, some people are helped. But in the aggregate, it's a much worse story, and the tragedy, I mean, there's lots of tragedies here, and especially with what we're doing to the kids, is that we're forcing people who don't want to take them, who in fact know that they're not working for them. Another really startling thing is they did a study, I think it was in Ireland recently, where we know that people under taking the older neuroleptics like Thorazine and Haldol and Melaril, those drugs, have an elevated death rate, mortality rate. But that since the people taking the newer drugs, that death rate has doubled, at least in this study.
Is it on your website?
Yes.
Is it psychrights.org for those who want to get that? Psychrights, one word, .org. Go ahead.
Yeah. So it's. I think what what happens is that there's this sense in the legal process, oh, if these people weren't crazy, they'd know this was good for them, and therefore we'll make them do this. And so we won't let their pesky rights, legal rights, get in the way of doing this. And so I view that there are really three pillars that we need to erect to fight this. One is really getting the knowledge out that this isn't true about the drugs being helpful, at least in the aggregate. We need to have alternatives for people, because I can win certain cases and have one, you know, case here and there, and have gotten people out, but it's not like I or anybody else is really saying people don't have troubles and don't need a safe place to go and get some help. And so I think society isn't really willing to just say, okay, we're not going to let people out even if they have the right to get out. So we really need to have some humane alternatives that allow people to get better rather than force them to remain sick.
We talked a little about this with Grace Jackson and Robert Whitaker, and it's always the question I raise when talking to people, because I'm an old Zaz and R.D. Lang fan and all that, but you know, when I'm confronted with, you know, people who say, well, what are you going to do when a person is in great distress or acting so weirdly that you don't know what to do about them, and, you know, entertaining what seem to you to be paranoid delusions par excellence, and, you know, freaking you out, so to speak, and you're living close to that person, or it's a loved one that you're trying to help. Obviously, you know, there's the facts, you know, which have recently come out, and if you're able to stand up and follow those facts, understand that against the overweening kind of medical establishment and psychiatric establishment and quote conventional knowledge, but and say no, you know, drugs don't seem to be the best thing, but what alternatives are available?
Well, the question is there are two questions: what are available and what might be available. And there was a study that I'm sure you've heard of, it, the Soteria House study.
Moschler,
from you.
Moschler, I think his name was?
Mosher.
Mosher, thanks.
And he showed that you could really get people through these episodes. And he passed away last summer, and it was a great loss. But he says what you need to do is be with people rather than do to them.
Right.
And in our society, basically, we don't have time for people. We shoot them up, get them calmed down. Where what needs to be done is people need some time sometimes, and maybe you need to spend some time with people. And I think people are entitled to that.
If you want to talk to Jim Gottstein here, the phone number to call in is 831-427-3772. I see we had a caller, but I sometimes will kind of have to put you guys who are calling in, it's not slightly on hold, because we need to catch what Jim's saying here. But please call back, because that's really an important part of what's going on here. We're not just talking to experts, we're talking to everybody and hoping to put everybody in touch with everybody else. What's the financial cost of setting up such a system of care or assistance? Are there insurance companies who are willing to deal with it? You know, has it been tried in any other countries? I mean, any answers to any of these questions, Jim?
Well, yes. I mean, first off, there's a great study, the Michigan Psychotherapy Study, which showed that you could do this and it wouldn't cost any more in the short run. And in the long run, there are huge savings because you get people better. And so what happens now is that people come into the system and they're made permanently mentally ill, and they end up on, is it Medi-Cal they call it there? But
yeah, we got a caller. Let's throw this caller in and see what's cooking here. Hi, caller, you're on the line with Jim and Robert.
Hi, Robert, it's Linda.
Hey. Hi, Linda.
I was going to talk, but not while he is.
Oh, okay. You haven't been listening to the show?
Huh?
Have you been listening to the show?
Yeah.
Okay, well, is there anything you want to say to Jim? Because he's on the line, too.
Yeah, first, I want to thank him for the style in which he's speaking about these important things, which I find balanced And I really agree with, from my own experience, what he's been saying and what the lady that called in was saying. I know young kids like that. Men usually now. In the 60s and 70s, it was a lot of young women that get locked up before they're even old enough to know they have any say in it. And the thing you were just talking about what can we do, you asked him what the financial cost was, and I'm really glad he responded telling you, well, think about the long-term cost. And I want to underline the whole cost, you know, like how much money is a human life worth? You know, saving people instead of systematically hurting and destroying them, you know, locking them up somewhere where they have no choices because you can make money on them, and then knocking them off with morphine in an old folks home when there's no way to get money. I want to say money for the state, but obviously,
well,
from what he's saying, it's not just that.
You know, I mean, my interest is in seeing such programs actually set up. And one of the questions...
Well, you remember Whitaker's book? He dedicated half a passage to talking about how comparing the Quaker homes...
Yeah, I know. He compared those. But the question is, where in this country or in the world, other than in these isolated occasional experiments... how is this to be done, is my question. How
the same way
well,
that the other poisons and abuses are going to be done. We have to build homes where support systems are in place that aren't quantified by, is this person worth how many dollars, but rather, you know, just like they used to have these TB infirmaries until tuberculosis was eliminated. And we can do that because we know we can do it because we did it before with a lot less understanding.
Jim, you say that's been done in Italy? Or?
Yeah, in the 70s in Italy, they actually passed a law that essentially abolished psychiatric hospitals. They let people who, you know, had been there a long time to stay there and if they wanted to come back. And it didn't stick throughout the whole country, but there are... I think Trieste is one where they actually have eliminated hospitals and they've got people in the community, and it's working fabulously well. In Bern, Switzerland, they've had Soteria Bern for, at least 20 years. And a psychiatrist by the name, I'm not sure I pronounce it right, Luke Ciampi, has run that and been very successful there. And in Finland, they have a program. And, and there's been a resurgence in interest in trying to do that. There's a relatively new organization called INTAR, which I forget what the initials stand for. It's INTAR.org, of people from around the world who are going to try are getting together to try and establish more of these. But I think I actually agree with both of you that there, for the policymakers, you really need to show that it's something that makes sense fiscally, that they can pay for, that'll work out. And I also agree that regardless of that, you know, people have value and they should not just be thrown away the way that we do. And the good news is that they're not really inconsistent, because it really does save money. And if you think about it, there's this huge crisis in Medicaid right now because of how much it's costing, and a pretty significant part of that are these mental health services and then SSDI, and it's because...
In California, when the rationing began, this was long before Schwarzenegger, they separated out mental health care from the rest of the state health care system so they could be a little meaner or tighter with that as one of the many budget-cutting tricks they thought of. Because, you know, the outcome is invisible. If people fall apart, they can institutionalize them. People like me that were just going to support groups or something. So it's an easy fix on the budget. So I think the thing you were talking about, to educate people about what's really going on, and, you know, what's behind these faked surveys, I mean, studies and stuff, that's so imperative.
Well, thanks, Linda. Anything else you want to add?
Not right now, but I'm certainly grateful and interested. Thank you for this program.
Sure.
Bye.
Stay tuned. We're on the air with... you're not a doctor, right? Or are you?
No, I'm an attorney.
You're an attorney, which is almost just as bad, right?
Well, until you need one.
Yeah, well, we definitely need them down here, no question about it. You just got to get yourself a California license and come on down. Although I guess you probably have needs up in Alaska. Alaska's got a relatively sparse population, right?
About 600,000 for the whole state. We have a saying up here, we could cut Alaska in two and make Texas the third largest state.
Uh-huh. Looks like we have another caller. Let's see what's happening here. Hi, you're on the air with Jim and Robert.
Hi, Chris Brazd again. And I followed Jim Gottstein's research to find that the neuroleptics shrink the prefrontal lobes and they build out the dopamine receptors. And they make withdrawal problematic because of so many dopamine receptors. And I mean, the brain compensates for these drugs. These drugs are a violation of three constitutional amendments. The main one is the Fourth Amendment. They seize the body. It's a violation of the free will. It's an attack on the person. It's been used against me to stifle my political speech. In 2002, they produced Janet Maidenwald. Dr. Mula, actually, who just finished torturing me with Geodon at high doses, Dr. Maidenwald produced a clinical depression in 2002 during an arthritic attack.
So, Chris, do you have a question or something?
Not really. No. September 14th or September 19th is my court appearance.
Pre-trial or arraignment?
No, I had the arraignment, and I instructed the attorney to remain silent, and I did get to speak. It was a visiting judge. I did get to speak to him about the try to get an order to stop the forced medication. They're not going to stop. The bourgeois mentality is conformal to their...
And the medication they're forcing you to take is what?
Well, they're not forcing me to take anything now.
Oh, they're not. Okay, so you're okay at the moment.
I'm fine. My father's undergoing his third series of electroshock tomorrow and for his third depression. He's retiring.
Voluntarily or
what?
This is his choice or...
Well, Dr. Billett, who is a prevaricator, lied to me about he covers up for other physicians. I had him as a physician at one point. He had my father on Seroquel, which is industrial strength garbage. And my father reacted to it negatively, but instead of let the Seroquel lift, he chose to do electroshock. I don't know whether his wife is trying to kill him or what. I mean, I really have to question the relationship between my mother and my father.
Well, there's a lot of pressure on people. You know, they a lot of kind of false hopes are held out by institutional psychiatry. Wouldn't you say, Jim?
Well, it's an interesting message because it's really a mess, largely a message of hopelessness that you have this defective brain, and we need to do these things to you. Electroshock is, you know, is truly barbaric, and it damages the brain and damages memory, and that's really the quote therapeutic effect, is that people don't remember what it is that's making them depressed, and
right,
and they have so many other problems as a result of the electroshock that that's no longer the presenting problem.
Chris, well, anything else?
Well, my father was nearly killed by the physicians twice. So he suffered depressions from over-irradiation of the prostate.
Chris, are there any alternatives in the area here in Santa Cruz? I know PERC, a psychiatric inmates' rights collective, has been trying to, you know, form their own patient advocacy groups and defend the rights of each other.
We've got to get to normal. I'm in the director of psychiatry. You got to file complaints with the California Medical Board. You've got to sue the shrinks. They're not going to stop.
I'm a big believer in self-help at this point. I mean, I think that with as screwed up as the mental illness system is, trying to get help from it is really a bad idea. And so... I think establishing safe houses, psychiatric survivors or ex-patients or groups of people that, you know, have safe houses where they'll help people, those kind of things, collective houses, peer support houses and consumer-run play. Well, I don't like the term consumer, but that's what it's called.
Well, it's ironic, in my father's case, he was a surgeon.
What's that?
A long time. So medicine really did him no favors.
you know, overrating his prostate, let alone recommending electroshock. That was recommended to me by Dr. Mayumwal, who produced a clinical depression. I'm extremely bitter. I resent her. I gotten over it because I realized I can go to law school and sue her. But the problem is the statute of limitations is only 1 year. We need to extend it indefinitely. Why should somebody be penalized just because they allow somebody to get away with damages and then finally get around to doing it? You've got to sue. If somebody damages you, you're going to continue doing it.
Well, let me ask.
It's a tough deal because right now the private bar doesn't consider it profitable. And, I mean, you've got these, you know, all these lawsuits over Vioxx, and so they see that.
I cannot hear you too well.
It's a real problem getting lawyers to sue the psychiatrist because they see it as not a very profitable endeavor.
Well, they have a massive profitability in the pharmaceutical company should be sued, the doctors. What's driving this abuse is the
problem. Chris, the problem is that you know, you can't get successful lawsuits, or is that true, Jim?
Well, typically these cases are done on what's called a contingency where the lawyers will normally get something like a third. And so they look at it as a business and a business risk. And one of the problems is that people that have been damaged by psychiatry, their lives have no value in the legal system because they're valued based on what are their lost earnings. I mean, that's the basic measure. And what happens is they've been destroyed so much, you know, they're homeless. You know, what are the lost earnings of someone who's homeless and been destroyed? Well, if you can prove that if it wasn't for that, then they'd have a nice job. I mean, you know, and they would have made X amount, but that gets to be in the legal sense, they call it speculative. And so you can't, and that's not allowed. And so the private bar is tending not to see these as profitable cases for them.
Well, the attorneys are way too comfortable. They're from a class of people, a bourgeois mentality that doesn't understand suffering. They do not understand it. They're not subject to it, any of it.
Hey, I'm gonna take you off, Chris, and allow for another person to come on. But thanks
right.
for calling in again.
Bye bye.
Bye bye. What about that? Attorneys are a separate class and often unsympathetic or simply inexperienced with you would be an exception because you yourself were incarcerated and forcibly medicated, right?
Well, I wasn't really forcibly medicated, and I was what I would call a involuntary voluntary, and this was over 20 years ago.
But you had the experience.
Yes. Yes, where I was said, if you don't sign yourself in, we're going to go to court on you, and I knew I wasn't in any shape to do that, and I didn't want it on my record. And I feel like I was very lucky to have escaped being made permanently mentally ill by the system because they told me I would never get better.
Have you ever, either yourself, successfully sued on behalf of people damaged by psychiatry, or do you have any cases that you can recommend to people who are interested in pursuing that avenue to get some sense of where it has been successful?
I think that I absolutely agree with Chris that the psychiatrist should be sued. I think the drug companies, you know, should also be sued, but they're incredibly hard to, you know, they've got incredibly deep pockets. It's called a huge amount of money. They'll fight tooth and nail, and they'll just bury you with what they do. But I think, I'll be blunt here. My view is the psychiatrists who are forcibly drugging people in state hospitals generally I consider cowards. And that if they started feeling like they were subject to personal liability for some of this stuff, that it would shake them up.
Have there been any successful lawsuits that you want to point people to? Any mention on your website or on other websites?
Not too many. There's a whole, it's pretty dated now, and actually I'm not sure where it is about, there's a list of cases, and people can look through that, but geez, actually I haven't looked at it for a while, so.
When you find it, maybe you can drop me an email and I'll.
I can probably find it. Okay, go ahead.
Yeah,
I'll do that.
Yeah, I mean, I'll pass that on to folks, because I know, you know, some people are determined, even if they can't find a lawyer, they'll try to sue on their own behalf. And, you know, some people have the tenacity to do that. I don't. I know often, but some
it's
do.
It's pretty hard, really, to work your way through the system without a lawyer. It's, you know, it's this guild, basically, and where people really have to know the rules, and it's very difficult to be successful if you don't know the right papers to file and follow all the rules, and that's very difficult.
So you can't think of a case that comes to mind where a psychiatrist has had to pay a significant amount of money for medication damage by medication or forced incarceration. I think
there have been some. I mean, I know even that the hospital up here was successfully sued, I think, about 15 years ago, and Dr. Peter Bregan was the expert witness in that. So there are some cases.
Because I know that I'm when I read, I kind of went through your website earlier, trying to prepare here for this, and I noted, let's see if I can draw it up. Let's see what we got here.
I found the webpage, by the way.
Oh, well, tell us about it.
Yeah, it's psychrights.org, psychrights.org/research/DAMCASES.htm. That's a few years out of date.
Is that something that's easier to find? If people go to psychrights.org, can they sort of, you know, is there an easier way to find it? Is it on the web?
I'll throw a link onto it on the first page.
Okay, sounds good. I notice, again, on your website, you mention, with respect to the Catch-22 aspect, the legal system, as the force of law article above shows, the conventional wisdom is the United States Supreme Court has ruled not only that federal rights in this area are determined under state law, an interesting concept, but that the forced treatment is permitted unless it is, quote, a substantial departure from accepted professional judgment, practice, or standards. So if you want to stop forced treatment by a writ of habeas corpus, which I guess, as you know, our first caller, Marilyn, talked about, is that successful much of the time in Alaska? I know here in Santa Cruz, I think it's like successful 10% of the time, and that's.
Oh, I doubt it. Is it successful 10%?
I could be wrong, but that I believe is what I heard from local George Cavallo, our ombudsperson advocate. I mean, most of the time people are of course deterred from even filing writs of habeas corpus. In these situations, a writ of habeas corpus, by the way.
Oh, you're talking about writs of habeas corpus. Oh,
right.
Okay.
If you're being held in a psychiatric ward and you want to get out,
Well, in Alaska, in terms of the involuntary commitment and forced drugging, patients lose well over 90%, maybe 99%.
Right. I mean, go ahead.
But we don't. There are very few people who are held long term in the hospital here.
Because the hospitals are cheap.
They drug them up and chip them out, and you know, and kind of arrange to make them to keep taking drugs. Or,
charming.
Yeah. Or people, you know, and a lot of people, of course, end up in jail.
Right.
And then they get drugged there.
You're on the air with Jim and Robert.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, I'm on the air.
You are on the air.
You know, I called, and actually I was trying to get on the air with Jim Gottstein. I don't know if he's still on the air with you.
He certainly is. Say hello to Jim.
Oh, Jim, how are you? And my name is Jeff. I'm the Southern California co-spokesperson for Support Coalition International.
Oh, great. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, and I see your emails all the time. Yeah, basically my story is, the reason I called in, I do advocacy work here in Southern California, and I just wanted to say, one of the problems with the forced drugging is people in positions of power don't seem to care very much. We have contacted all sorts of authorities. I mean, I've written to the governor, I've written to this person. For whatever reason, when the Welfare and Institutions Code was changed to allow incarceration in California, they didn't put in proper safeguard, just like the psychiatrists are supposed to be self-policing. And there's such a credibility with doctors, a lot of people just assume, well, doctors will not do bad things. In fact, I have one case where a woman was locked up in a psychiatric facility, and the other side was arguing when it went to the Court of Appeals that, you know, the doctors and the hospitals are required to do this and required to do that and to do such and such a thing to safeguard people's rights. And I wrote that that's like people are required to not rob banks. so they must not rob banks. This goes on all the time, and for whatever reason, the powers that be just seem to think that, or at least they act like psychiatrists will not do bad things because they're medical doctors, and it's just not true. It is amazing what some of these people get away with, and I'm certainly not trying to disparage every psychiatrist or every doctor, but I have yet to run into someone in California, whether it be a supervisor, like the Board of Supervisors in LA County, or whether it be some people in the state legislature, the assembly, or the state senate. I have yet to run into anyone who I can tell cares about what is going on, and we have complained and complained and complained.
Jeff, let me ask you a question. In L.A. County, that was a pilot program for AB 1421, the Needles on Wheels program?
Yeah, actually, that I've never gotten really into as to what that whole thing was about. Basically, I get calls, I have a little ad in the Yellow Pages, Psychiatric Abuse Law Office. And I get calls and I hear stories, especially from Citizens Commission on Human Rights, which does a lot of advocacy work fighting psychiatric abuse, that there are people who are locked up and family members will contact me or contact CCHR and are bewildered as to what is going on. And a lot of times these doctors in the psych facilities or the hospitals will just make up things in records. So this way they're covering themselves for civil and criminal liability. And one particular case...
Can I say something here? Which is, what you said about them making up records sounds, that can't be true. But I know absolutely that you're right about that. It happens all the time.
Yeah, what happened in a case some years ago, in fact, I asked, it was the Medical Board of California to check into the records. So the Medical Board of California, they look at the records, and according to the records, the doctor in the hospital did nothing wrong. I believe they talked to some staff members, and they look in the records. Well, according to these records, the hospital didn't do anything. Well, of course it's what's going to stay in the records. Why would a nurse, why would a doctor write in the records, we're violating somebody's rights? You know, the person shouldn't be here, and we're billing the heck out of Medi-Cal, and it's wrong. Let's put it in the records. They're not going to put that in the records. And you can't get through to the medical board. I've seen this happen more than once, where the powers that be just talk to the staff or look at the records and determine that nothing bad happened because the records said it didn't happen. It would be like if I was a serial killer and I wrote in my diary I didn't kill anyone today. I don't think that would be very good evidence, and I think they could still find some ways to convict me. But unfortunately, the scam of the medical records has been going on. I don't know how many times a year this happens. I don't know how many years it's been going on. But the powers that be have got to stop blindly accepting the word of psychiatrists, the word of the nurses.
So, Jim and Jeff, what's the answer? What kind of reform, if is possible, if anything, to, you know?
Well, I keep getting down to this idea of effective representation, because the way that the system is designed is, you know, we have the legal system is this adversary system, where they have a lawyer that, you know, does their best, and the psychiatric respondent has a lawyer, and that lawyer does their best, and somewhere between that, the judge or the jury finds the truth between what's said. But what happens is that the patient's lawyer throws the fight. And so the legal system is broken. And there's just no countervailing force, no control.
What about the specific concern about falsified records? Is there any potential reform on that either of you can see?
Well, the only kind of reform I could recommend is something I sent a few years ago to the state legislature, and in fact I've sent it to more than one party. It has to do, and they have never responded to this, and I really didn't expect them to. There's a conflict of interest when doctors recommend somebody be held involuntarily. That is, the hospital makes money. The bill they had been somewhere around $1,500 a day in a lot of these facilities. I don't exactly know what it is now, but between $1,000 and $1,500. So there's a natural conflict of interest, but because a doctor can make his facility by money saying, you know, we've got to extend this hold, this person needs help and all that. What the government could do, and I don't know that they'll ever do this, is have a neutral psychiatrist be sent around from hospital to hospital. After somebody is incarcerated in one of these places for, say, 2 days, this psychiatrist makes a recommendation. He doesn't make any money if the person is released or not released. And I did the math on this. Say they ended up releasing just 20% of the patients held involuntarily. The state of California, which certainly is not doing that well financially with the billions of dollars that it is in debt, the state of California could save millions of dollars every year and not millions of dollars cheating anyone, millions of dollars very legitimately by upholding people's civil liberties, by having neutral psychiatrists make the decision instead of these psychiatrists who work for the facility. That's at least one thing they can do. You'll never completely get rid of the lies and records. That's just going to happen. They're going to cover themselves. You can understand why they do it. Otherwise, I don't have any other recommendation other than getting watchdogs in there. Unfortunately, locally in Los Angeles, patients' rights is a joke. When I reported a death about 5 years ago, I couldn't even get them to do an investigation of a woman who's a senior citizen who she's in her 90s. She was there for 3 days, and she died. And I went to the head of patients' rights.
Jeff, I think, you know, you deserve, frankly, an hour yourself. Sounds like you've got a lot of information. If you'd like to call in, you know, next week, or actually on Sunday, I'd like to have you on the air talking. You know, you got a lot of information to give. But I think, Jim, you had a comment on this.
A couple. One is that what's been found is when they've tried to get neutral psychiatrists, basically they're not neutral, and they tend to just rubber stamp. But more interestingly, I think, is the MacArthur Foundation did a study about this issue of who's telling the truth, and they found that the patients' accounts were just as likely to be true as what's in the records. There's actual research on this.
Jeff, have you got a website people can go to if they want to get more information about the group you work with and what you do?
No, but I have an email address that anybody wants to email.
Sure. Why don't you give it?
Sure. It's Jeff Lussman. I'll spell that. JeffLustman at yahoo.com. It's Jeff Lussman at yahoo.com. If anybody emails me, I'll email them right back. If they want me to call them, I'll call them right back.
Yeah, if you want to call me off air, and if anybody else wants to leave messages off air, they can too, at 831-423-4833, you can, and maybe we can set up a time for you to discuss these issues at greater length.
Okay, when do you want me to call?
You can call right now. It's a voicemail. Just leave the information. I'll get back to you.
I'll do that. I should also mention I've done radio shows with two other people, one from CCHR and another attorney. We've been on the air, the three of us, together, and maybe we can do it again because among the three of us, we got a lot of information.
Well, maybe you can round them up and we can do it here on this program, on this show.
That'll be fine.
Hey, thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
All right. So, to me, you know, we have two basic kind of hurdles we have to deal with. I mean, a profound hurdle is, of course, finding psychiatric alternatives. And we talked a little about that, and you've given some hope that in other countries this has at least been pursued with some success, and, you know, that it's certainly more cost-effective. I don't know if there's any bills either in Alaska or California or the national legislature that hold out any hope on this front. Do you know of anything happening there?
Well, there's a group of us here in Alaska that are really pushing very hard here, and I think there's some hope that we'll be able to get some of these alternatives going. And so there's that. And of course,
How long you been trying to do this, by the way?
Couple years,
yeah.
2.5 years maybe.
Okay, so we're not talking 20 years and not getting anywhere. It's 2.5 years and maybe getting somewhere.
Yeah. And of course, there's a Proposition 63 that passed last year in California, and I remember the California Network of Mental Patients, or I think it's something like that, and they were told that money was really going to be used to fund these kind of things, and I think that they feel betrayed at this point. In fact, they were told that none of it would go into forced treatment, and I frankly thought it was a little bit naive, but I think it's proven to be a lot of the money is trying to be funneled into forced treatment.
Now, while we're,
I put treatment in quotes.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, while we're on that subject, if for those who are interested, the current issue of Street Spirit, which is a local California homeless newspaper written by a number of people, but published by the American Friends Service Committee, and online at thestreetspirit.org, for those who are interested, all one word, small letters, thestreetspirit.org, has an interview with Robert Whitaker, which kind of updates the Anatomy of an Epidemic article that you talked about, and also has a discussion of this very situation with Proposition 63 and the struggle to, you know, make sure that it actually is a voluntary situation, not an involuntary one. Apparently, they're going back and forth on it. I think it is the August issue. There's a description, homelessness and psychiatric abuse. It's an article by Michael Deal. No, it's another article, but there's
a whole series of articles in that issue.
There is, and it's apparently still ambiguous. I mean, there is still a struggle to make sure that funding, which is an unusual taxing the rich. I think it taxes everybody who make over $1 million a year. It's a strange,
right.
It's a strange kind of. I think the right kind of tax for my money, since I don't make $1 million a year. Anyway, if people want to call in, we still got you on the line. Can you stay a bit longer? What's your schedule like?
Yeah, that's fine. I can stay a little bit longer.
Yeah, we're talking with Jim Gottstein up in Alaska. He's with PsychRights.org. Actually, who are you with? That's your website, but
yeah, it's a law project for psychiatric rights.
And, you know, the call number here is 831-427-3772. Again, 831-427-3772. If you've got questions, comments, anything you want to add, go ahead, Jim.
One of the things that I wanted to mention is that, and I know Dr. Jackson mentioned Mind Freedom when she was on, Mind Freedom has this program called the Mind Freedom Shield. And if you go to mindfreedom.org, there'll be a link to it. And the idea is that everybody who signs up for it forms a support network, and they commit to taking some sort of action if someone else on the network is facing forced psychiatry. So it might be calling the press, it might be calling the hospital, it might even be, you know, a protest march out of the hospital or something like that. And I would really encourage people to look into that. And also very important is what they call advanced directives in many states, where you can specify in advance what kind of drugs you want or don't want. And the legal theory is that people have the absolute right to decline medication, except if they're not competent, if they're mentally incompetent to do that. Well, the determinations of incompetence really are a sham too. But if you have an advance directive that says that you don't want it and you were competent, if no one can say that you were incompetent at the time, if you haven't been found incompetent at the time you wrote that, that's supposed to be honored. Now, I can't say that it will be honored.
Has that been tried in Alaska? Because I know Grace Jackson was suggesting that when we interviewed her a couple weeks ago.
It's in the state law, and we're encouraging it. And
has anybody actually, you know, walked around with a bracelet, you know, and that says, "I want these drugs. I don't want these drugs," and have their, you know, their statement with them, and the courts have said this is legitimate and upheld them, or has there been a test case yet?
I had a case where the court would have done that if the person had it. I mean, it's such a joke up here. I mean, as it is everywhere under the Alaska statutes. There's a statute that says when the state comes in and moves to force drug someone, this supposedly neutral court visitor will come and do an investigation about and make a recommendation about competence. Well, they've gotten to the point where the public defender won't let the person interview their clients, and so it just doesn't happen. And so that part of the...
Why
the
is
law,
that?
It just is ignored.
Why? Again, this is Alaska we're talking about, but why won't the public defenders, is it some sort of my
because
territory?
It's a sham. They just automatically say, oh, this person's incompetent. And they made up the questions. I mean, there are, you know, psychological tests, and, you know, the MacArthur Foundation had an instrument that they did, which is basically flawed, but at least it's something, where there's some, you know, something behind it to try and determine it, but it's the Office of Public Advocacy up here actually just made up this series of questions, and they have no training.
What's an example of one of the questions?
Hmm?
What's an example of one
God,
of the questions?
Oh God, I'd have to. I don't even know.
That's okay. You know, I would like to be able, and you may not be the person to talk to on this because you are up in Alaska, you're not a California attorney and not terribly conversant with California health and safety or health and welfare and safety codes or whatever.
But what? Let's suppose a person is listening to this show and wants to know how she or he can deal with a forced incarceration. What should he or she do? When the, you know, we saw what happened on the street. Well, I mean, we got a forced, you know, incarceration with this guy, with Chris. He told us how he was seized for disturbing the peace. That's a criminal charge. But frequently you get a civil commitment, which is, you know, 72-hour hold, and they want you to take this psychiatric poison or that one. And what... Here you are. You're the legal advisor. What do you suggest that person do? What would you do in that person's shoes?
It's easier to say in Alaska, and not so much for the legal reasons. And you'll probably be surprised to hear me say this, but they don't hold people very long in Alaska. And so in Alaska, if you don't have someone to really fight for you, I'd say, you know, just take the damn medication and get out of there in 3 to 5 days. And hope that you never have to go back. That's what I would say. In California, I think that my impression is that they really do hang on to people for a long time, and even years from what we're hearing. And so that's not maybe as viable a strategy. I really think this Mind Freedom Shield program, if it really got going, you know, could raise raise a ruckus. They've been successful, really, in getting people out.
So maybe what people could do in California or even in the local Santa Cruz area, if they were interested and wanted to form such a group, would be to have a sort of a hotline that people could call, or they could email, or their friends could email, and then people could essentially put pressure on hospital authorities.
There's a group in Northampton, Mass., called the Freedom Center, and they've really banded together, and they're doing great things. And we've got this program. It came out of this action conference that Mind Freedom and Psych Rights, mainly Mind Freedom, but Psych Rights was a big sponsor, put on last spring in Washington, D.C., where we are trying to recruit state coordinators for each state to fight forced, quote, treatment. And the idea is that we're trying to identify lawyers who will really fight, identify psychiatrists who are willing to testify as expert witnesses, because you really need that to have a viable chance, and have these coordinators to put that together.
You got a California coordinator yet?
No, we don't. And I think with California, we probably really need at least two.
If people go to your website, psychrights.org, there's an opportunity for them to volunteer if they want?
Yeah, and they can. There's a contact form, or people can email me at jim@psychrights.org.
So we're talking with Jim Gottstein here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. You're tuned to 101.1 FM and also www.freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norse. We've got another 45 minutes left in the show. Jim is from Alaska and has been working for, you say, a couple years? I think you've been probably working for longer than that on this issue.
Well, I've been working on mental illness issues, mental health issues, for over 20 years, actually. I was involved in a lawsuit against the state where they stole 1 million acres of land that was given in trust for the mental health program, and that actually ended up in a $1 billion-plus settlement and the creation of this mental health trust authority. And I was on the Alaska Mental Health Board for 5 years until I sued them, and then I didn't get reappointed, which I knew I wasn't going to anyway. And I've been involved for a long time.
That could be a perfect place to begin those kinds of alternative therapies. Are there any interest up there in doing that?
I think that in a lot of ways we have some advantages for doing that, and I actually wrote a report about it, things that we've been trying to do, and there's a link to it on the homepage of psychrights.org. And we're trying to get a soteria-like program, which is an alternative to hospitalization, and we're trying to get a community-based program called Choices, which is really just what it stands for, is to allow people to get the kind of help that they want, rather than be forced to do things that they don't want.
We have a situation where President Bush is pushing for kind of the medicalization of the young around this issue. At least a year ago, he was proposing massive screening.
It's happening.
And tell us about that.
Well, it's they want to, quote, screen all the kids in the country for early identification of mental problems so that they can be, you know, referred for follow-up. And I consider it nothing more than a drugging dragnet. And then there's been a kind of a hue and cry over, oh, it's not mandatory, it's not universal. And so they said, well, and they point to words about this and that. But there really are many programs around the country that have already started screening. And they have this, what I consider totally illegal process, which they call passive consent, where they send home a consent a form that says, if you don't object, send something back that says you object, we're going to screen your child. Because there's a federal law called the PPRA, the Parental Privacy Rights Act or Amendment or something like that. I can find it pretty quickly. So they're trying to get around it by doing what they call this passive consent. Well, it clearly doesn't comply with the Protection of People Rights Amendment, it's called. But in any event, it's going on. In fact, there were some articles in some mainstream newspapers just within the last week about this. And it started, the first program really was probably in Illinois, and there was some furor over that, but it's been quietly being implemented around the country because the drug companies really have these tentacles everywhere, and they, you know, I mean, there's literally billions of dollars at stake here, and they can afford to spend some money on this, and so they just go in and they get this school district or that school district.
Perhaps the assassination, as Pat Robertson might advise, of every third drug company executive?
Well, we really can't advise that, can we?
Indeed.
I mean, there's one, I think it was a Pfizer executive that started talking about how unethical all this stuff was. Anyway.
Well, I'm going to wind this down. I think we give you listeners out there a few more moments if you want to call in and ask any questions of Jim Gottstein, who's up in Alaska weathering the. I guess you got a long summer up there, right? It stays late until light until real late.
That's pretty much past us now. We're moving into fall and stuff. So, but we've had a great summer.
Well, don't drop into a depression as the winter hits.
You know, I've lived here all my life. It doesn't really bother me that much. But I go to Hawaii for 2 weeks.
We should probably ask for you on a homeless report on Anchorage next time you're out. Tell us how things are for civil rights for homeless. But maybe I should ask you that now. What's the situation with forced incarceration and people who are homeless up in Alaska? I know that homelessness is probably less of a problem in the winter since they either freeze to death or I guess there's laws about requiring people even to pick up hitchhikers in Alaska, right?
Not anymore.
Really?
There's a couple of shelters. And in the wintertime, people go to them. They can only stay in them for 30 days, so they go from one to the other. There are these camps around town. People get picked up. Some people, when it really gets cold, do something to get arrested so that they won't freeze to death. There are, quite a few people that do freeze to death every year.
Really? Any stats for last year?
I don't have them. There was one advocate that was keeping track, and there's actually a list from a couple years ago on a website called akmhcweb.org, and on the left side there's a link to it's in memoriam, and there's some there's a list of the homeless people that have died, and Anchorage is pretty indifferent to the homeless here.
Like everywhere else.
For example, in Fairbanks,
which has really brutal winters, they care much more about the homeless. But here, it's everybody just wants them, you know, out of sight, out, you know, out of their backyard, out of the, you know, off the streets.
And is there, you have an involuntary outpatient commitment deal where they can court mandate you taking medication even after you leave hospitals and things like that?
It's on the books, but it's not used very much here. They have other ways of really forcing people to take meds, the drugs. You know, take the drugs or you'll lose your apartment. Take the drugs or... You know, we won't do that. Take the drugs, or we'll put you in the hospital. But the actual outpatient commitment law is not used very much here.
Well, Jim, I appreciate your taking the hour with us. I also really enjoyed reading what I was able to read. I rush around doing about a dozen things at the same time, so I don't take the time I often should to prepare for these shows, but I do appreciate your, you know, taking the time to, well, what you've said has been interesting, and I'm hopeful, really, it needs to be more than interesting and more than amusing and more, even more than educational. It needs to be inspirational, because there's a real task ahead of us for those who want to make sure that we aren't bequeathing all this to the next generation.
Yeah, I think we really need to get past talking about it and doing things, and PsychRights really has a plan, you know, of what to do, how to really fight this. And Mind Freedom, you know, is a great sister organization. And there's a group of professionals called the International Center for the Study of Psychiatry and Psychology, ICSPP, it's ICSPP.org. And the three organizations together, I think, you know, really can be effective, but we really need help. People should do what they can. They can email me. We need the state coordinators. We need people to be banding together. We need people to be doing things. We need people to be actually creating alternative housing, creating alternative places for people to go and be safe and not be hassled. And that's really what we need to do.
And again, if people want to get in touch, you're looking for a California coordinator, and if folks are looking for more information, they can jump on your website, right?
You bet, psychrights.org.
Hey, expect you to get back to us at some point.
You bet, I'd be happy to.
Thanks, Jim.
You bet.
All righty.
Bye now.
Bye-bye. And now the phone lines are open, but we got no guests, but you can be the guest. So call in if you've got comments to make, and you can make them, 427-3772. I'm going to be talking a bit about Iraq tomorrow night. Our own very own representative, Sam Farr, is coming to a town hall meeting at the Santa Cruz City Council Chambers, 6:30 to 8:30. If you want to ask him why there's nothing on his website about conscientious objectors, nothing about resources for resisting the war in Iraq, and very little about anti-war activity, while massive amounts of information for the military, not a hell of a lot of help for the military, I might add, for vets who come back and are looking for some kind of decent treatment. You can go and talk to Farr, or you can try to talk to Farr, assuming you don't get arrested, and perhaps you won't. You know, I say stand up and speak your mind. You can always leave if they tell you to leave, rather than stand and get dragged out, as some of us do. Or perhaps if we have enough people who stand up, they'll listen to us rather than drag us out. That could always happen, too. That's tomorrow night, 6:30, at the Santa Cruz City Council Chambers. It's a town hall meeting, which Farr has announced. I got an email from him, and it may have been in the paper today. I didn't read the paper very carefully. I also tried to talk to Bonnie Moore today. Bonnie is United Transportation Union. That's the potential bus driver strike coming down the pike. I talked briefly to someone at her office, or actually at her home, and she said there's no new news to report yet. But I think today, at least according to the Sentinel, was key, because the Metro may be imposing a settlement, and that may result in an immediate strike. And
Again, my tendency, in spite of getting a lot of interesting information from Paul Marcel and Sampson, is still to support the strikers, because I'm not really hearing alternatives for people who are struggling in this situation, and could be just knee-jerk unionism on my part. I'm always hoping to see more on this issue. I invite debate and discussion, and encourage people to talk about it, and that's going to be possible. It still is possible for the next half hour if anybody wants to call in. If you're a person who's going to be impacted by the strike either way, or you have any view on it, please call in and talk about it if you'd like. I also will be perhaps hearing from Lisa Molyneux today. She's the person who's opening up Greenway, and I had hoped she was going to be opening it in a couple of days, but there's been slight delay. Apparently the planning department hasn't gotten back to her yet, and the police department, she's just working out the plans for security through the ever-vigilant Rudy Escalante, sergeant who's apparently working with her on that project. And that's going to be happening hopefully next week, so maybe in the middle of the Labor Day weekend they'll be opening Greenway, the first medical marijuana club in Santa Cruz since 2000, in spite of the city's very restrictive medical marijuana law, which has essentially prevented clubs from opening until massive pressure on behalf of Lisa and against this ordinance, I think, have forced the council's hand, forced Rotkin and Riley to get off their butts and do something about this, not to mention the suffering and needs of many medical marijuana patients who might not even the small number that is served by WAM, 200 or 300, compared to the thousands that aren't, are finding themselves in trouble because of the Raich versus Ashcroft decision. And WAM, as you know, is, or may not know, is, I think they've given up the growing end of it. And so there has to be distribution centers, there has to be distributaries, I guess. The people who are in a collective or a cooperative are able to grow themselves on their own property and share. But, of course, you know, that's risky. You know, theft is a significant problem because of the black market policies of the federal government and the collusion of state and local governments. Yes, the collusion of state and local governments has driven this up. We don't hear the city council talking about making marijuana, not just medical marijuana, but marijuana generally the lowest priority. Instead, we get knee-jerk police department appropriations, police department grants from these prohibitionist federal agencies that are pushing for continued criminalization and massive incarceration is what it amounts to. 750,000 arrests last year nationally. And we don't have even the vaunted ACLU's drug policy group, which is defending Valerie Corral for a bullshit bust down south, I guess at Burbank Airport, when they took her medication and gave her a citation or dragging her into court. Don't seem too interested in defending anybody locally, like Roger Minch, who got an absurd sentence, even though it was light. He was dragged in for his Hemporium up in Felton. And he's still appealing that sentence. I don't see any city council figures. Actually, I take that back. Mike Rotkin did give a letter of support to Minch, and I commend him for that. But generally speaking, you know, it's interesting. Minch is outside Rotkin's jurisdiction. I didn't see Rotkin doing anything for people like Peter Koch and the folks who were opening the Pacific Coast Cooperative. Had it open downtown, but suddenly it had to close because in the forbidden zone, forbidden zones for marijuana, forbidden zones for homeless people, the forbidden zones, of course, all dictated by our wise guardians who run the small businesses downtown and then pressure the council and engage in this collusive activity, which tailors, kind of trims the Constitution to the wishes of the Downtown Business Association. The most recent activity, of course, is an ATM machine will be going in shortly. You know, these ATM machines, I don't mean an ATM machine, I mean a change-making machine. It's going to be going in at on Pacific Avenue. There are a number of them, and you might say, well, that's a convenience for people to be able to make change for the Cynthia Matthews parking meters that are everywhere and getting extended in time. Hey, why not? And, of course, the answer is that there has been the laws drawn up by Rotkin and Kennedy make it illegal to sit down within 50 feet of an ATM or a change-making machine. And there's going to be one now at the corner of Elm and Pacific. That's, of course, where all the young folks are. Isn't that a coincidence? Interesting stuff. I think we got a caller here calling in. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Robert.
Hi, Chris Brost again. Listen, my opponent, Sam Farr, is complicit in torture, extrajudicial murder. Sam Farr is a war criminal. He's not moving to impeach the president. He's complicit in the activities of this regime, this criminal regime in the White House. I need to get to D.C. to impeach this man. The drive for impeachment is on. Sam Farr is in violation of his Eighth Amendment right against cruel and unreasonable punishment. He's done nothing to alleviate the sleep deprivation, which is cruel. It's the third violation of his constitutional oath is the ordinance of MC 636010 violates the right to travel or not to travel under the Equal Protection Clause.
Well, you're talking about a city ordinance, you know. What would you have Sam do federally?
Uphold his oath to the Constitution and open campgrounds nationwide for homeless, alleviate this suffering. It's so easy to do. He doesn't have the political will to do it because he doesn't have a mentality to do it.
Uh-huh. Okay. I mean, I certainly support that proposal. So you're going to be speaking to him or trying to speak to him before they drag you away for
a I'm going to call him a war criminal to his face. It's as close as I could get to him, you know. That's what he is. He bombed Yugoslavia, a million refugees from that war. That was the first imperialist war that NATO opened up.
You're talking about the war in Serbia.
Yeah.
Yeah. Back in the late 90s.
In 95, they bombed the Kordina Serbs. All the Serbs left. Every single Serb in...
Well, I know that Farr has been recently, you know, supportive of the Walesy Amendment to supposedly set an exit strategy maybe sometime somewhere to get out of Iraq. And he also has been behind the Walesy letter, and he's going to be at the Walesy hearings, which will be before the big demonstrations in Washington, September 24th through 26th. But he did, I believe, vote in favor of the last huge military appropriation in spite of maybe voting against some amendments. So I still see Farr as a legitimate target in terms of sitting in his office, in terms of protesting his appearance, demanding he do more. And so I hope folks do show up. I won't be there on Friday because I've got a family engagement, but I wish you well with that. Anything else, Chris?
No, I'm going to be there, and I am the alternative to the war criminal in the White House, and the one complicit with war criminality in the U.S. House mm-hmm. of Representatives.
Okay, well, folks can go online and they can check out your website on that issue.
Yes, they can.
And that website again is
simabue.home.mindspring.com/index.
And rather than go through that, is there a simple Google they can?
Yeah,
do?
Google my name,
which is
Chris Brosda,
spelled
B-R-O-Z-D-A.
Thank you, Chris.
Thanks, Bob.
Bye-bye. Phone lines are open, 427-3772. Yesterday I put out as a flyer Tom Hayden's People's Petition for an Iraqi Peace Process, and I handed it out to some people via Huff activists were at the SAFE event. SAFE is Society for Artistic Freedom and Expression, and that's a group that meets every Wednesday, and has 82nd meeting doing singing and performing in front of the New Leaf Market. So I'm going to be talking about that in a moment, but we have a caller on the guest line. My goodness. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hey, Robert, it's Lisa.
Hi, is this the notorious Lisa Molyneux, the Greenways guru? Or Greenway guru, I should say.
The Greenway painter today.
I just mentioned that I thought you might be calling in, and I may have stolen your thunder, but what's happening with our first ever marijuana dispensary in 5 years? Except, of course, for the ill-fated open up, get a good time story, and find yourself dumped.
Yeah, I hope that's not going to happen.
Dispensary that happened on Pacific Avenue.
Yeah, we're hoping that's not going to happen. So let's think positive.
You think positive, I'll just think in my usual way, but I appreciate your positive spirit.
Well, we're just getting the space ready right now and kind of waiting on the police department a little bit with their approval of the security system. And I really don't see that being a problem. I think maybe they're just busy, you know.
How long have you had to wait?
Oh, it's only been like a week. So, you know, I can't really expect it to be quite that fast. But I am going to start, you know, knocking on doors Monday if I don't start hearing something, because he needs, you know, the police department. I think it's been passed off to Rudy Escalante. He says he needs to approve our system. So he either needs to look at our layout or he needs to come to the building and look at it. But
have you set up a security check to make sure that no masseurs come into your center?
Yes, or I guess no harvesting in the place either.
No what?
No harvesting.
Harvest meaning you can't clip your plants there? Or?
Nope, can't do any of that. Not for 6 months anyway. So, and then you know, after we do the jail sentence, we'll see how it goes. But you know, what we have to count on is that patients will, you know, abide by the law that they tried to lay on us, which is the 600-foot, keeping the premises free of loitering. And, you know, there's really not an issue with that now. So I've been out there for the last week painting, and there have been a lot of patients stopping by to see when we're going to open, which is really great. So I'm going to be putting some information up in the window so people can come by and figure out ahead of time what they need to bring the first time they come in.
Woe betide the patient that dares to medicate in a nearby park, eh?
Well, you know, we have to educate them to not do that, but
it might alarm the horses, yes?
You know, I can't patrol the park, however.
Well, yes, but when the police department calls in and says, we caught your patient medicating herself in the park, then you will be obligated to cut that patient off, right?
Well, I hope it won't be that drastic the first time it happens. You know, I'm hoping that there's a system of, you know, at least reprimand, you know, at least, you know, wait. If someone is seriously causing problems, then we take their card away. But, you know, I'm hoping that that doesn't happen.
I think
most people want the facility there. So I think they're going to try to, you know, try to participate. And if they are going to do it locally, they should just do it discreetly.
So if somebody, for example, has a marijuana brownie, and eats it in a nearby park.
Well, they better be able to prove it.
Are you suggesting to me that if a police officer observes this, then you're going to have to, you know, either warn that person or, you know, suppose they repeatedly eat brownies in the park nearby.
I think there's probably a lot of brownies that get eaten at that park.
Yeah, but we know those special kind of brownies that are, you know, so-called medication. We know this is really a cover for recreational use.
I guess they better have a radar that's set up for that.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, I'm of course dramatizing this because I think these restrictions are absurd and unnecessary. And plus, of course, are you walking around following Cynthia Matthews dictates that every house in the area be informed of your poisonous presence and who's in charge and all that sort of thing?
Well, actually, it'll be more like a flyer that I send to everybody and invite them to the barbecue.
Just going to be
I've met with several local business owners just by walking up to the door and talking to them, and that started a year ago.
Did you share a joint with them, or should I ask?
No, I didn't.
Heaven's sake. I hope you didn't do any alcoholic drinking or toasting. That would seem
not
to me to be...
Not yet, anyway.
There's probably going to be beer, but no marijuana at your opening barbecue.
Yeah, wouldn't that be funny? You can have alcohol, but no pot.
What kind of... there's been some negative response in the press. You may have noticed the letters. They're opening up this grotesque marijuana crime center in the Harvey West, and there are all these homeless bums around. And if you've seen perhaps you've seen some of these letters.
No, I haven't. Where were they at?
And the Santa Cruz Urinal. I mean, the Santa Cruz Sentinel. Actually.
Really? Recently? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, last couple of weeks.
There weren't
many of them. There were a couple of them. I mean, if you want, yeah, just...
you know, I've been just inundated with trying to get open. I haven't really paid attention to the paper. Every time I drive down the street and I see one of the paper, you know, dispenser things, I think of pulling over and buying it, but then I'm like, when will I have time to read it?
Well, it's not usually worth reading, so you're not missing much.
Well, I'm going to have to go look those stories up, though.
Well, if you call me up, I will try to point you out. Maybe I can email them to you. You can go online and the Sentinel and look that way, too.
And they may also be on the ASA website.
They may be, though. I think that you know,
post
these
articles that have anything to do with it.
Well, these are cranky letters from, you know, from some people with some, I think, unjustified apprehensions, and I'm only mentioning them just because.
Well, I'm going to have to go search them out. But,
oh,
you know,
forget it.
I expected that because it's such
a... waste your time.
Well, it's just, you know, I expected that because it's new.
Well,
and it's a little bit ambiguous, and people don't know anything about it.
Well, perhaps you can set up a small kind of a Cindy Sheehan memorial in part of the, and have a special marijuana. I guess they wouldn't want marijuana over there. They would be considered to be too retrograde. They're dealing with a hostile population in Texas. Well, listen, we're talking with Lisa Molyneux. If anybody got any questions for her, she is on the guest line, so you can call in 427-3772. And ask her anything you want, but quickly, because I'm going to roll very soon onto my next exciting topic.
So, what have you discussed so far?
Well, we've just spent the hour talking about psychiatric abuses and oppression, how institutionally it's a really bad scene, and that we need alternatives to forced medication, forced drugging, the psychiatric over-drugging that's... You know,
well, they do that so that they don't have to take care of, well, you know, anyway.
Well, I mean,
he's
actually...
Asleep, he's easy to take care of.
Well, you're one of these alternatives. I mean, marijuana is a natural medication. The problem is, of course, it's more expensive than gold these days. I mean, probably what I should be advising people to do is sow marijuana seeds throughout the town so people could harvest their own marijuana and forget this absurd, you know. But,
well,
in fact, I do advise that. I suggest people do that.
Hopefully we can get the price below the price of gold.
Right. I mean, you have a low-income marijuana program plan for the poverty-stricken, right?
Yes, I do. And that might take a month or so to get off the ground, but we're going to do all we can in the beginning to help everybody that we can. So, you know, we have to kind of try to qualify those people because everybody will come in and say they need free marijuana. So we have to; those people have to come to us and let us, you know, look at their Social Security. I don't know. We have to figure out how to do that. There's
going
to be a way to qualify those patients. Whether the home, like maybe Huff can help with some of the homeless people.
Sure. We would be happy for a major kickback, of course. We'd be
Yes, of course. Donuts, right?
Well.
Brownies.
Brownies? But definitely of the non-medicinal kind. I'm more of a, you know, a walnut brownie guy. Actually, I can't stand walnuts. Anyway, we're talking with Lisa Molyneux, and I thank you for calling in, Lisa. How can people reach you if they want more information, or should they try to reach you? Should they wait for to hear from
you?
Well,
actually, there is actually a phone number that will be operating as of Monday, and that will be 420-1640.
That's pretty easy, 420-1640.
420, that's a good one, too.
It certainly is. Lisa, thank you again for what you're doing, and I will try to get some Huff experts to head your way to, you know, share in the proceeds.
I think when the painting stage is done, I'll be able to go around to some of the agencies around Winston City and try to figure out what they're going to be able to do to help qualify people.
Sure. That sounds good. And
so it's all on the menu. I just have to do it one step at a time.
Well, let us know if the police department gives you trouble, and we will start complaining as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Robert.
All righty.
Bye-bye. Bye.
So, I was saying before, I put out a printed version of a democracynow.org, which you can go by going to that website, summary of Tom Hayden's peace petition. And he calls for, the way he describes it, as a confidence-building measure, the government or our government has to declare it has no interest in permanent military bases or the control of Iraqi oil. The government has to set goals for ending the occupation and bringing all the troops home in months, not years, and begin with an initial withdrawal of troops by the end of this year. Third, the government has to request that the United Nations be the monitor of any process of military disengagement or de-escalation of the United Nations or some body blessed by the United Nations, authorized by the United Nations, organize a peaceful reconstruction effort. The U.S. has to fairly compensate Iraqis for damages, has to assist Iraqi reconstruction, and at the same time eliminate the imposition of these privatization schemes over the Iraqi economy and the dominance of U.S. contractors in the bidding process. Fourth, the government should appoint a peace envoy, independent of occupation authorities, independent of the Pentagon, to underscore the commitment to an entirely different mission, which is a peace process to end the occupation and bring the soldiers home. And the peace envoy, and this is the final point, should be encouraging and cooperating in talks with Iraqi groups opposed to the occupation, including insurgents, to explore a political settlement. The settlement has to include representation of opposition forces and parties, power sharing, and the protection of women's rights as core principles, and so on. Now, I mean, parts of this sounded good to me, and parts of it didn't sound so hot to me, and but I had some apprehensions that were crystallized when I went on the Counterpunch. Counterpunch.org website, and read the following article by Stan Goff, which I'm going to read some of. I don't know if I'm going to have time to read all of it. You can check it out. It's called The Hayden Plan, Containing the Anti-War Movement. I'm going to read it here. I feel compelled once again to be a skunk at the party, Stan Goff writes, but it's a role I'm growing into. Cindy Sheehan's squatters' camp has re-energized the anti-war movement. But just as it has done so, it has also re-energized the herd dogs of the Democratic Party, who fear nothing more than an independent mass movement. Cindy plopped down outside the Bush Gopher Ranch on a 98-degree day. The cops told her to leave. As tactfully as she could, Cindy advised them in less scatological terms to piss up a rope, putting the cops, the Bush administration, and the Democratic Party in a dilemma. Got an incoming call. I'm going to take that one first, but briefly. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hey, Robert's Kirk. There's a message for me.
Oh, yeah, did you want to talk? You're on the air.
I'm on the air.
Yes. We can talk later, or we can talk on the air now.
I don't care. I kind of wanted to pick your brain about what's going on around here. I'm just kind of flabbergasted.
You know, maybe we should do that. Are you going to be around on Sunday? Because we only have 10 minutes left in the show, and I wanted to read something. So are you going to be available on Sunday morning, 9:30 to 1 sometime?
I work every day. I like to... If I was going to go on the air, I think I'd want to talk to you first.
Well, why don't you call me after the show and call me on the Huff line, and anybody can do that. 423-HUFF is the number to call, 423-HUFF. And then I will call you back.
Got it.
And we'll talk some more. Because you have some concerns about the deputies, right?
It's gotten really, really, it's bizarre.
You want to give us a one-minute summary before I go, or do you want to wait on that?
You know... If you're gay, you're screwed. I mean, I got these people coming down on me like you wouldn't believe around here, and they're not doing nothing. I mean, there's no one-minute summary for this stuff. It's nuts.
Well, let's give
it's
some
time. It's so obvious what they're... I think the sheriffs don't do anything to prevent anything. They just kind of wait till the bank's robbed or the person is shot, and then they come and do a report. And I think everything's preventable if you do your job.
All right.
I don't know why we have deputies, but I'll call you later. And
yeah, let's talk more about it. I do want to give you time, and when you have time, we'll be able to put that together.
Right.
Thank you.
Thanks, boss.
All right. Bye. So, continuing with Stan Goff on the Hayden Plan, neither the cops nor the administration wanted to be held responsible on camera for dragging away the grieving mother of an Iraq war fatality, her son Casey. For a moment, they were hopeful that there would be an untimely end to this little action when Cindy collapsed from severe dehydration on the first day, but alas, she rehydrated and reappeared the following day and began attracting mad media. For the Democrats, of course, of whom exactly one elected official, Maxine Waters, has deigned to visit Camp Casey, this presented quite another problem, the same problem that the whole movement against the war presented prior to the last electoral farce in 2004. The masses were moving to their left and threatening to expose this moribund Weimar formation as the waste of both money and oxygen that it has repeatedly demonstrated itself to be. But Joshua Frank did an excellent job recently on this site of describing the Democratic Party. I want to talk about something more specific, and that is one of the tactics being employed by the partisans of this rotting political edifice to try and contain the newfound energy that exploded onto the scene at Crawford and threatens to fill the D.C. Mall with malcontents on September 24th. And that is the exit strategy proposal drafted by Tom Hayden and being vigorously pimped by policy-encrusted liberals all through cyberspace, the print media, and soon enough on television. This is the oral formulaic appeal to reasonableness and realism of weak-kneed liberals every time a mass movement threatens to gain any momentum. We have to present a reasonable alternative, always a policy alternative, of course, and we have to face the fact that we can't move our agenda without accepting a realistic, watered-down approach. You kiddies have acted up enough now. Go on and play. Leave the rest of this to Daddy and Mommy in Congress. Republicans, of course, are only at risk of losing a tiny sliver of their base among the strictest libertarians over the war. The Democrats are already grooming a few 2008 candidates, including the execrable Hillary Rodham Clinton, who has stated her desire to beef up the war in Southeast Asia. Let's not forget that her husband presided over an Iraqi Holocaust that George W. Bush is still trying to match. The Republicans are secure for now with their white nationalist popular base. An active and increasingly militant left is a more immediate threat to the Democrats, who have prospered from the Republican reaction for decades by capturing social bases they feel they have that have nowhere to go. That dilemma is real, but it is also predicated on the notion that to go there, we need to contain ourselves in electoralism and pluralist policy fights that are engineered by corporations and NGOs. That's why Sheehan and others who propose the radical option of simply leaving Iraq are now being surrounded by the friendly faces of, quote, progressives who will try and redirect this newfound mobilization along the acceptable policy debate paths. Enter Tom Hayden with his proposal for disengagement in Iraq. Hayden's proposal appeared recently in the L.A. Times, where he explained, "The rallying cry of out now expresses the belief that the Iraqi war is not worth another minute in lost wars, lost honor, lost taxes, lost allies, but its very simplicity makes the demand easy to ignore or dismiss," unquote. Oh, thank you, O wise one, for instructing us on the finer points of political realism, and thank you for putting words in our mouths that have us express precisely the kind of chauvinist horse manure being shoveled out of the Democratic Party's stable. Most of us oppose the war because it is cynical, amoral, imperial crime. To hell with allies and honor, and don't worry, we will not be dismissed. Cindy Sheehan, one of those naifs who say out now isn't being dismissed now, is she? Except by Tom Hayden, who in a patronizing tone calls Cindy's bring them home now position a moral stance. Tom says that we deserve a hearing, and that means we'll have to propose an exit strategy of our own, which is actually Tom Hayden's. By the way, Tom, we intend to be heard one way or another, unless you mean we deserve to be heard with our respectful hats in our respective hands by the venal leadership of elected officialdom. Your statement is a non sequitur, by the way. There is not anything about our deservingness that in any way suggests we have to propose some abstract, unenforceable, debatable for the next 5 years exit strategy. But thank you oh so much for validating us in our deserving. Tell the surviving families of those thousands of Iraqis whose corpses rotted under the rubble of Fallujah that they deserve a hearing. Where do you people learn to talk like that? Is there some kind of secret school for Democrats where they get a graduate degree in weasel wording? Here's Tom Hayden's, quote, plan. First, as confidence-building measures, Washington should declare it has no interest in permanent military bases or the control of Iraqi oil. It must immediately announce goals for ending the occupation and bringing all our troops home in months, not years, beginning with an initial gesture by the end of this year, unquote. Tom, old boy, I can't help myself. This is bullshit. Are you joking about this? Guarantees from the U.S.? You've been to Pine Ridge lately? Ask him about guarantees from the U.S. government. Perhaps you can explain to some of us why this administration would ever offer a guarantee to turn its back on the central goal of the whole Iraq invasion. Let me propose a different confidence-building measure to reach out to Iraqis. We make the political cost so high in the U.S. for continuing the war that it threatens the entire U.S. state with destabilization. Just an alternative suggestion, you understand. More of Tom's exit strategy, quote-unquote. Second, the U.S. requests the U.N. or a body blessed by the U.N. monitor the process, and so forth and so on. Tom, are you having a mescaline flashback? The United Nations? What nationalities, pray tell, will be under those Carolina blue K-pots? Or does the U.N. employ angels? Moreover, why in the world would the U.S. or the Iraqis need anyone to oversee a disengagement? Here you propose a plan that is allegedly going to conform to a set timeline, yet it is utterly dependent on the script being followed by the actors over whom the U.S. exercises little to no control. Let me say something about how to withdraw. This is my plan. Hey, if Tom Hayden is qualified to write up exit strategies, why not an old grunt like me, huh? The plan. The National Command Authority orders all U.S. forces redeployed out of Iraq within 1 month and out of the theater in 2 months. Any commander that fails to meet the deadline will be summarily relieved and replaced with a commander that will thereby be placed on a shorter timeline. I can promise anyone who has no experience in the military that this is perfectly feasible and that with that kind of command emphasis, the mission can and will be accomplished. that Stan Goff, part of what his he has written attacking the Hayden peace plan, which he regards as Democratic Party herding of the strong and impressive energy released by people like Cindy Sheehan and the Camp Crawford, the Camp Casey at Crawford, Texas, anti-war protest that continues to this day. You're listening to Bathrop Spears Broadsides. I'm going to have to sign off because coming into the studio shortly is Uncle Dennis. And I'm going to leave you with a few interviews that perhaps Dennis will let continue while he sets up. He's not here yet, but he will be shortly. I want to thank you for being with me on this edition of Bathrop Spears Broadsides. And on Sunday. Saturday I'm going to be out of town. Sunday, Ed Davidson will be here. He's an activist in Santa Cruz. He'll be talking about the Brown Act and the Seaside Company and a bunch of local topics, which some people may find very arcane, but I will find very interesting. So join us then, and join us at 9:30 when the show begins, and give me a call off air at 423-HUFF, and I'll be with you there and try to get back to you when I can.
August 17th, about 10 to 1, talking with Nick and
Tiffany
here in front of New Leaf Market. These are folks with fancy-looking bikes, I've said that before, backpacks, and they've also been around town on and off for the last 4 years, but things are looking different.
Yeah, a lot different.
How so?
There's a lot less hippies and punks, and there's a lot less... Well, there's some music being played right now, first I've heard in a while.
And the old sound of the... It's not the Alpine hunting horn, it's something else.
It's a didgeridoo.
There we go, thank you. I was looking for the word. You were saying there's less culture in town, Tiffany?
Yeah, I noticed there's a lot less culture, there's a lot less street musicians. I noticed there's a noise ordinance sign at the end of Pacific Avenue that I didn't notice or wasn't there before back in 2001. So I think it's really taken away from why people come to Santa Cruz in the first place, is to see all the culture and artisans on the street. There really isn't any now. So that's
but
unfortunate.
There's lots of shoppers, eh?
There are some shoppers here. But people go to a mall if they want to shop.
What do you think this is, buddy? Show your credit card or get moving. I don't know what to say to that, do you? What about you? I think your T-shirt says, ninjas flip out and kill people. Is that some sort of violent terrorist threat?
I think it's just more of an expression of my mental stability rather than anything else. Yeah. Or mental instability. It's funny, haha.
So, have you been mostly in Santa Cruz? Are you two an item? Are you separate? Are you? What's your deal? Are you living together? Have you been living together for 4 years or?
A lot longer than that.
Oh, how long has this relationship existed?
This is like teenagers.
Now, is this an open relationship? Should I attempt to hit on one of you?
No.
Yeah, there you have it.
Cool.
So, monogamous interaction here. So, any other changes in Santa Cruz you want to note?
Just the art scene. I mean, I really haven't been here that long. I've been here about a month lately, so just the diminishing art scene, really.
And by the art scene, you mean?
I mean performance art on Pacific Boulevard and general artsy-looking people walking around. It seems to be less of them, even though this is Santa Cruz and it's still a convergence point for those kinds of folks. It seems muted in a way.
Hey. Thank you very much.
You're welcome very much.
Tiffany and
Nick.
Through the healing voice and the dirty wind blowing across. And as Robert moves slowly out the door, you are greeted by your Uncle Dennis here on Freak Radio 101.1, www.freakradio.org, and possibly a few other places on the internet that even I don't know about. Stay tuned now for From the Cream to the Dregs, a weekly exploration of the music of the 60s and 70s. And, of course, we will be playing lots of rock and roll for the next 3 hours. Of course, at 9 o'clock, we will have the Earth First update. But since this is From the Cream to the Dregs, why don't we start off with the Cream.
Time is over, no, no, no.